gentleman is still afternoon, apparently. Good morning, good afternoon. All right, Cousins versus Commonwealth, Mr. Clements, Mr. Jeffrey.
Thanks, sir.
Would you like to reserve any rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
All right, sir, you may proceed.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, before we begin, we will take a lunch break shortly. I know that we'll deal with the Cousins case and probably Sanchez Castro, but Butler we will deal with after lunch. So if y'all want to stay, you can. If you want to go take a break, that's fine too. Be back here at 2 o'clock. Okay, proceed, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is David Clements, and I'm representing Mr. Cousins in this appeal. On January 3rd, 2013, after hearing the evidence, Judge Stephen McCallum found him guilty on 4 charges, 1 unauthorized use, misdemeanor, felony hit and run, driving under the influence of alcohol, and driving on suspended license. At all points during the trial of the matter up until finding a guilt, he was represented by Mr. Richard Fuller, who unfortunately became quite ill and subsequently passed away. I picked up representation after that before the sentencing hearing and then on this appeal. On November 20th, 2013, he was basically given a 2-year active sentence on the felony hit and run, a 6-month active sentence on the misdemeanor. We've made 4 points in our argument, and regarding all of which are sufficiency of the evidence. As the court well aware of, this court, the review requires the court to find the judgment of the trial court was plainly.
In the bottom line here, on all 4 assignments of error, sufficiency, that your position is the defendant was not the driver.
That's one issue. That is a main issue in all 4 points, yes. And if you'd like me to address that, and I'll cover all 4. Specifically,
well,
he never.
You can argue however you'd like. I just want to be sure I understand the issue.
That was one of the issues, but also in regards to the first one where we find that there's insufficient evidence in regards to that this was a felony hit and run. There's also no evidence in regards to injury or any knowledge that he knew that she was injured too. So the court's familiar with the standard.
Well, weren't those 2 points, however, conceded? The latter 2 points?
At what point?
There was a lady who was injured and taken to the hospital. I thought that at trial that was conceded, and also that the appellant himself acknowledged that he had taken the car from the lady owner without her knowledge or consent.
He takes it without her knowledge, not necessarily without her consent. He does make that statement. I believe that's the big difference there. There's no inference in regards to she was denying the use of the vehicle. They don't have that because the lady who owned the vehicle at that point was not present in court, and the Commonwealth even referenced the fact that she was not present because she was now making inconsistent statements to what she initially told the police officer. In regards to the injury, again,
was that the owner of the vehicle who was making inconsistent statements, or the person taken to the hospital, Tanisha Towns?
Ms. Towns, there is no explanation as to why she doesn't testify at all.
Right.
She did not testify.
But Crystal Spruill.
There was explanation from Ms. Hoy on the record as to that. That was the reason why she was not testified. She did not want to create an issue, is what she says on the record. In regards to, we believe it was properly preserved. When defense counsel does make a motion to strike, and even Judge McCallum on the record says, first, Mr. McCullough is challenging whether the evidence is sufficient. So he's acknowledging that this was a sufficiency argument, maybe not the most artfully argued by my former counsel in this case, but we do think it was sufficient enough to bring the issue to this court here today. So going specifically through the elements in regards to the felony hit and run, they need to prove that the appellant was the operator of the motor vehicle, which is obviously a key element in all of these matters, that the motor vehicle was involved in an accident in which a person was injured, and then lastly, that he knew of the injury and then fled the scene. So my understanding of the Commonwealth relied on is basically a statement that he ran from the scene because he was scared. That again, There's no, he does never say that he was the driver, but he said he ran from the scene because he was scared. He had nothing to drink since the accident. That's responding.
What would the passenger be scared of? If he wasn't the driver, what would he be scared of?
Police involvement or contact with the police at all or anything.
Didn't he tell the officer, the sergeant, that, you know, he took the car without her permission, took her keys, and she didn't know he was driving it?
Took the car without her knowledge, yes. Again, I don't think he says without her permission, but he says takes it without her knowledge. And that's another reason why he's probably upset at that point. Now, again, the last statement that they made is they've taken the car from Ms. Sproul. So, in this case, and then specifically, we had a gentleman came in to testify on the defense behalf of Mr. Tyrone Green, whose testimony basically comes in and says he was the driver.
Until then, I mean, your client had never mentioned Mr. Green, never mentioned anybody else who was driving even, did he?
No, I'll concede that point. He never did bring it forth, not at that scene of the accident. That was his trial, and that's when he advanced his defenses at the day of trial. That's the proper place to do it. He doesn't necessarily have to tell everything to the police officer. I agree that may create making some circumstantial evidence that he was the driver, the fact that he does not raise that point, but doesn't necessarily, he never does say he was.
He never even mentions Mr. Green. And there's evidence that he's at least aware of Ms. Towns because her cell phone is ringing with his number on there, right there at the scene.
That's correct. That the officer does testify that he observes her phone repeated. He gets a number from her, doesn't necessarily say the number, and says he has dispatch call that number, correct. That is delineated in the record. But again, if he's a passenger in the vehicle, maybe not necessarily the driver, then he is could be calling her for any number of reasons.
Is it significant that during the interview with the police officer, he never denied that he was the driver?
I think that is obviously a factor for the court to consider.
In fact, the court mentioned that.
The court does mention that, and the fact that at no point did he ever come forward and that this other individual didn't come forward, the court does cover all of that in regards to what he views as the credibility of that witness. It is, I think, a factor for the court to consider, but I also think it is important to consider that this gentleman walks in willing to take the stand and admit to two felonies, and I think that goes pretty strong to his credibility as well.
And who determines credibility, us or the trial court?
Well, I think we all know the trial court is the bearer of that, but you can't necessarily arbitrarily discount all of the testimony. In this case, that to me is a factor. I respectfully argue that he's arbitrarily dismissed, summarily dismissed it, even though
But he gave reasons. He gave some very specific reasons for why he discounted it. So it isn't as though he just said, well, he's not credible.
Well, he did articulate on the record some of the reasons why he did not think he was credible. But it is my position that his testimony, considering the fact he was willing to step up, come to court, admit to being a principal in two felonies, as well as tell the story of how it happened, from my review of the record, I did not see any inconsistencies in what he said versus what, and that's part of what we're asking this court to obviously review here, because we're here on this standard to review it as insufficient evidence, and that's part of the evidence that the defense presented.
Did you raise, in your motion to strike, did you raise the hit-and-run issue?
The hit-and-run issue, yes, was raised, and again, it was argued as sufficiency that of that element of that charge as well, yes.
But did you argue that that she wasn't injured?
That was not as artfully articulated, and again, I did not argue that trial of the matter.
Okay,
I argued that sentencing. It was not as artfully articulated as I would have hoped for. However, I do think there's enough preserved on the record as the court acknowledged it was
well,
a sufficiency.
Well, on appendix page 41, didn't defendant's counsel in the motion to strike indicate that a lady was injured?
Counsel does make that concession, and let me make sure I'm on the right page, right?
I have appendix 41.
You are correct, and I've marked the same thing. And he does mention that a lady was injured and someone was injured and transported to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
So where does that leave your argument on? That
makes
nobody
my argument harder, that's for sure. And I'll
perhaps
concede.
Impossible.
Well, I like challenges sometimes.
Yes, sir.
And so I must advocate for my client's position. And in this case, again, there was no evidence that she was injured. There was, other than that concession, with all due respect to former counsel, there was no testimony from her that she was injured, no EMTs, no doctors, no one came forward to testify that she ever was injured. At best, we have Sergeant Aronson testifying that she was crying, hysterical, holding her
head. But if you tell the trial court that you acknowledged that she was injured and taken to the hospital, how can you then argue to the trial court something differently? Isn't that an approbate and reprobate?
Well,
I mean, you're asking the trial court to disregard what you conceded.
Again, Your Honor, I didn't concede.
No, I don't mean you. I mean trial counsel.
I understand, Your Honor. I'm bringing forth what I think are the strongest arguments based upon the record that we do here. And I concede that, but I also see later where the court then also recognizes the sufficiency of the evidence type of argument. So, again, she's found a quarter mile from where the car was found, about a mile from where the defendant was found, crying, setting hands on her head, but there's no testimony. She does leave the scene in the ambulance, but there's no testimony in regards to any specific injury that the officer testified. So there's nothing in the record other than Mr. Fuller's statements that acknowledge the injury.
And then I'd like to ask you about on page 38. Are you saying that the language to be found there isn't an acknowledgement that the defendant took the vehicle without her permission?
Let me get to that appendix page. I don't want to misspeak. Appendix page 38, Your Honor?
Yes.
What line is your referring
I'm
to?
I'm sorry, I didn't make a note of the
it's
line.
It's lines 11 through 17.
Thank you.
He advised that he took the vehicle without her permission, and Crystal did not know that he had it. That's the last line of it.
Thank you. I understand, but again, did not know he had it. It goes to his...
Without her permission.
Without her permission.
That's unauthorized use, isn't it?
Well, I think permission is obviously a key element, but again, there's no corroboration to that. So all we have is a statement without her permission or knowledge. It's a casual statement. So what we have here is, again, the owner of the vehicle, the Commonwealth chooses not to call because she is basically told the Commonwealth attorney she's going to testify differently than what she told the police officer. So we don't have anyone to corroborate that it was without her permission because the Commonwealth chose not to bring that person to court.
Well, does trial court, is corroboration necessary?
I think if we're talking admission about the key part of that, yes. I think there has to be some level of corroboration to his statements if they're used as an admission of his criminal activity.
I would like for you to provide a case that says that.
I don't, and I apologize, but that was my understanding of it.
Because I don't think you'll find one.
Well, then I submit.
But if you do, you're more than welcome to send a letter to the court including that case.
I understand.
Thank you. All right, so you may proceed. You're into your rebuttal. You can continue or you can reserve your remaining 2.5 minutes.
Well, specifically, again, no admission that he was the driver. Mr. Green admitted to be he was the driver. Mrs. Towns did not testify. Mrs. Sproul did not testify, the owner of the car. So no one testified in regards to injuries at all. There's no testimony at all in regards to his knowledge that she was injured. And when it gets to the operation under the other, on my third point.
Isn't there some case law that says that if there's a significant damage to the car, that there's, you can't say presumption, but an inference that there might be an injury.
And that's where we're getting to. Yes, there is case law that talks about that inferences are permissible, and that's one of the cases I cited.
Specifically, that is the...
But the reverse isn't necessarily true.
Well, and basically what this case is, and talks even about the real case in here where there was a $400 worth of damage, it talks about you cannot necessarily infer the person was injured, and they basically found that that was insufficient evidence finding guilty because there was lack of physical evidence there, so they couldn't make the inference that he did it. That he at least knew that there was an injury in that case. So similar to what we have here, there's no testimony in regards to the damage of the vehicle, so we can't say whether or not that would infer that knowledge to him. We have the reason why we make our arguments here today is we think there were some impermissible inferences taken in this case by the trial judge, and that we understand it raised suspicion in all these cases, but we think it would be insufficient to find him guilty. Thank you.
All right, so you have a minute left. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jeffries.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Donald Jeffrey from the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Commonwealth. I think, as we argued on brief, the vast majority of what's before you is, in fact, defaulted because these points were not raised below. I would submit to you, because it seems to me that on the one sufficiency thing, the only thing we've heard is the judge essentially articulating, I find the evidence sufficient because X and Y, which, of course, is certainly not tantamount to counsel saying there's a problem with the sufficiency. The fact that the judge, when the gavel comes down, says, I find him guilty because of these factors is not enough to preserve an issue for appeal, and I believe that's what you've had in this record. I've tried to scour the motions to strike, particularly after all of the evidence, with some detail again since writing the brief, and I don't think it's there. As far as operation, as the court has pointed out, Green testified. His testimony was rejected. We don't believe it was arbitrary for the reasons we stated on brief. There was the friendship, which was admitted on the record, and you've got detailed citations about that. I can elaborate if you'd like. You've got the delay in reporting. His testimony was a little hard to understand. I mean, frankly, I had to read it several times, but I think the trial judge got it right, and I have detailed citations to where his testimony appeared. I think there's a good argument it was internally inconsistent, but he said, and I don't think it's an unfair reading, of the last statement that Green gave about the accident was consistent with, essentially, I moved it a short distance from the wreck, and Sergeant Aronson clearly testified that the vehicle was found about a quarter of a mile away. So there was that disparity. The judge did hang his hat on that in part. And again, I think if you look at all the places to the record that I cited, I think the first two times, I think he talks about it twice, might arguably be more consistent with what Aronson said. But when the trial judge probed him the last time, I think the judge actually prompted the response. He gave one that read in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, but is certainly different from what Sergeant Aronson said. Again, not to belabor the point, Mr. Green also had a prior, I guess, juvenile adjudication that would have been a felony. And then also the other thing we had.
There's just no testimony about Mr. Green being mentioned by anybody until he shows up at trial to say he was going to, that he was driving, right?
That's correct. And of course, as the court has already discussed, that was one thing the court expressly relied upon, was that omission. At first I had trouble wrapping my arms around it completely, but I would note that one of the things kind of screamed out to me as I was preparing for this argument is Aronson actually administered field sobriety test on this gentleman, which of course is what you do when you suspect somebody of driving under the influence. And I think particularly given that fact, the judge's reliance on that, fairly heavy reliance, was certainly not misplaced. Some of the other statements, perhaps, I ran because I was scared, and that doesn't necessarily say he was the driver, but I think particularly in light of the fact that he was in fact administered field sobriety test and asked questions about if he had anything to drink, that was not an unfair inference for the court to draw.
Is it a bit of a stretch at all to say that because Tanisha Towns was found crying and hysterical, and then she's sitting on the side of the road, and in a good distance from where the car is found, but that and they called an ambulance and took her off in an ambulance, but because she was crying and hysterical and sitting on the side of the road holding her head in her hands and went off in an ambulance, that she was necessarily injured rather than just maybe really upset with whoever left her there?
I'd like my argument less if it were in fact reserved on that point, Judge Fields. I'd probably argue the point with you even under those facts. I would take issue with one thing you said. I think, let me look at my notes, because I believe that Aronson at one point testified. She was actually found fairly close to the vehicle, as I recall. I want to say he said 20 feet or 20 yards. Appendix 62, my notes say.
I thought she was a quarter of a mile, but maybe I missed.
The vehicle was about a quarter of a mile from the impact site. That's where the officer's located. But if you look at Joint Appendix page 62, at least that's what I have in my notes.
She was close.
Not let my notes make a liar of me. I think he said 20 to 30 feet, if my notes are in fact correct.
20 to 30 feet.
Right. From heavily damaged guardrail.
62 to 63 is where that is in the joint appendix. So she was actually close. You know, again, I think light most favorable to the Commonwealth, we don't have a crystal clear picture of why Towns wasn't called. Apparently, she was under subpoena, I have to say. If I looked for that, I didn't find it. I can't recall whether I looked for that when I was writing the brief or not, but I think that's been represented, that she was under subpoena. Sprowl, we have an explanation in the records to why she wasn't called, but it is sort of silent as far as Towns. But were we here on the merits, I think it's still over the bar, probably just barely over the bar, but I think it would be.
But your argument's 518.
Correct, Your Honor. And of course, the court knows, and probably the most recent published iteration of that is Brittle, which of course is pretty clear that you have to have an affirmative showing of a non-crime or innocence in the record, as opposed to that the evidence wouldn't have been sufficient. And going all the way back to Redmond, of course, the court has said that, you know, otherwise essentially the exception would swallow the rule, and that anytime you had a meritorious argument, you could get around the default, and that's clearly not the law. And I think because of that, this is bar number 518, and there is no ends of justice exception that applies in this case to the facts here. But I do think you're correct. It's a little troubling that we don't have Towns' testimony in the record, but again, even were we here on the merits, I think we probably would have enough to pass muster on that.
Mr. Clemens, in answer to my question, sort of indicated that there was no evidence as to the amount of damage to the car. And I thought there was, and I may be confused about this, that there was indication that there was some significant damage, and which might allow, based on case law and inference, that there was an injury.
While I'm looking in my notes for that, Judge Beals, I will say also that I think one of the things that distinguishes this case from the other cases is that we actually have the injured party in the same vehicle. Every case that I found, and certainly was cited by the parties, involved instances where the injured person was in another vehicle. So I think that's one very pivotal distinction. There is testimony about substantial damage to the guardrail, and again, I'm sorry, I hate to break eye contact here, but I'm looking at my notes to see. There was also testimony, and I cited both in my brief, I believe, that the damage to both.
On 62, it says it had very heavy front end damage.
Okay, 62, I use the word substantial, but it's not in quotes. Okay, that describes the vehicle, and there was also a description of the guardrail. Would you like me to find that?
That's right under it on 62, it looks like now. I see it myself.
And I have.
The guardrail was pushed away from the roadway and looked like it was struck pretty hard.
Okay. And actually, on brief, I also cite to 23 and 47 to 52, and I'm guessing that five-page citation kind of weaves in and out at some point, but I certainly cite all of those to you as well. So you did have, I use the word substantial, that wasn't in quotes apparently, and that was not a direct quote from the record. So you have all those factors in terms of the knowledge or should have known, which of course is this court's standard. And putting her in the, you know, there was the issue raised, again, not preserved, about whether she was in fact, we had adequate proof that she was a passenger, she was a short distance away. We also have that, and it was described at some length, the efforts that the defendant made to contact the injured woman by Towns by cell phone, and that's pretty well laid out as to how the officer accomplished that, and that there's no evidentiary concerns raised about that on appeal. As far as the operating without permission, interestingly, both Green and the defendant admitted that the vehicle was taken without permission, and the court pointed to page 38 of the joint appendix, and I guess I'm talking about Green's testimony, 47 to 50 covers Green talking about how that was taken from Sprowl without her consent. If the court doesn't have any other questions on those points, the DUI, opposing counsel didn't mention that. I've covered that fairly adequately on brief, and I would note to you, I think there are certainly some purely legal arguments that might get us beyond even where he is, and I lay those out in the brief, but the only thing that I would say to you was, the argument basically was that we had evidence of adequate performance on the field sobriety test to overcome the certificate of analysis in this case, and of course, I pointed to some deficiencies in the performance on the field sobriety test. bottom line is something that created an issue for the fact finder at most, and that's questionable under this court's jurisprudence, which is that the cases for that are cited on brief, and I can discuss that at more length if you'd like. But again, that too, I believe, is also barred under 5A18. I don't recall that he made that argument. But
didn't he fail the field sobriety test?
That was the officer's testimony, and he described at length some of the things that the guy did poorly on. What the defendant attempts to say on brief was where there were some things that weren't so bad, and that's obviously laid out in the brief now. And when I wrote the brief, I just kind of did a superficial analysis of that, and I said, you know, some of that I think probably is fair from the record. Others I think the record may be silent on. But in any event, again, even assuming that you could undercut a certificate of analysis with those types of tests or good performance on those types of tests, which would seem to be inconsistent with this court's case law, and I've cited you the cases
given
here on
the
brief,
0.08 that presumption.
Right, that at most it creates a factual issue. And also, I did cite an unpublished opinion. I don't believe it's clear from this record that we actually convicted this gentleman under the per se part of the statute. And this court's talked about that sort of interplay in another case. It may have been under subsection 2. I don't think it's ever enumerated that the court relied on the presumption. So I come back full circle to, okay, he either relied on the presumption, which can't be rebutted by field sobriety test, or he didn't rely on the presumption. That the 08 was certainly part of the mix. And at, I think it was 08, I think the PBT was 0.10.
Well, in this motion to strike, counsel said Mr. Cousins was under the influence. He's scared. I think he was very scared, and he made these statements, knew the car was taken.
Okay. And I don't remember if that may have been the one after the Commonwealth's case in chief. I'm not sure. I will say that the court's picked up on a couple of places where perhaps there were affirmative concessions that I didn't cite to on brief, which actually makes the 5A18 reprobate arguments even stronger, I would suppose. But I don't believe that you're going to find any affirmative place in here where the issue was preserved at best, and at worst, and in some instances, there were concessions. But going back to subsection 2, Judge Beals, if again, you have the 08 in the mix, and then also the various factors that play in factual issue for the trial judge at most, and sufficient. Even were it preserved. Unless the court has further questions, I submit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Clements, you have a minute.
I do.
I do note in the record now, even though I don't think they talk about monetary amount of that damage, it does note about some front end damage on the vehicle. It's my understanding from my read of the record, she was found a few feet from the impact to the guardrail, but a quarter mile from the vehicle where it was later came to stop.
I see. So the vehicle was in near 20 to 30 feet, just where the damage, where it hit, impacted. Okay.
Yes, that's where I think the record.
Okay.
I thought, at least that's my interpretation of what I've read in the record. And again, we feel that the ends of justice exception, even if the court feels that it was not properly preserved by former counsel, that the ends of justice, this would be a miscarriage of justice that occurred here because of the missing key elements, particularly on the hit and run. No testimony in regards to injury, no testimony in regards to his knowledge or anything to demonstrate his knowledge, even with front-end damage. That doesn't necessarily get to that proper permissible inference that of his knowledge. We think there's some impermissible inferences done in this case. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel, and the court will take a recess. We'll be back on the bench at 1:45.